official podcast of the National Museum of the Surface Navy in affiliation with the Surface Navy Association's Battleship Iowa chapter. We're here on board today. I'm Marianne Fengler. I'm here with Mike Getcher, our COO, and we are back for part two of our weather conversation with Joe Sankiewicz. When we left off, we had been talking about cruise ships and cargo ships and their self-tending winch systems that keep them on the dock during big storms. So let's get back into it. So address one question that we get a lot since we're on this subject. Why are we not using chains to hold us to the dock?
I love that question because the answer is we can't. There's multiple things. The easy first answer is that we've got an approved mooring plan. So we start there. You know, we actually have a mooring plan that the Navy approved and the Port of Los Angeles approved. We have some question about the capability of the bollards. The bollards are the things you tie off on the dock. The bollards that we have are a mixture of 125 ton, or in some cases we believe them to be 50 ton bollards. So think about that. We have a line with 400,000 pound MBL, a breaking strength, that's basically 200 tons tied to a 50 or to 100 ton bollard. You know, you're going to start ripping things out.
Yeah.
The good news is that the mooring lines also stretch. We have a specific specification. Once again, it's been approved by the Navy. It's a nylon line, so it stretches with you and it absorbs some of that shock. I also talked to, you know, one of the major marine engineering firms of literally the nation, and I'm pretty sure they're actually international now, a local company out of Long Beach, but all over the world, Moffat Nickel. And I spoke with one of their engineers up north in San Francisco, at their San Francisco office, and he said they did a preliminary study for the USS Hornet. And they found out really quickly something that we would have suspected anyways, and that is that the bits and the shocks on the ship cannot handle the strain of coming up hard on a chain. A chain will have, the way I would set this up is I would put a heavy chain with droop in it, you know, which would help you center. But at some point, if you come up hard on that, it's like a thing, you know, it's a sharp, sharp jerk, and you're going to start breaking things on the vessel. There's no question about it. So if we ever do a chain arrangement, under these conditions, let me be very specific too. If you're in the calm backwaters of some small harbor somewhere, you could probably chain this thing up all day and never worry about it. But I'm on the main channel of one of the busiest harbors in the world, and we have this added issue of what we've talked about today, which is this tremendous surge a few times, you know, in a year and worse every decade or so, coming up the main channel. You know, and that's a tremendous, very powerful effect. And something that is difficult to design for. The mooring system we have is designed for, I think it's the 100-year storm cycle, or whatever you want to call it, you know, 90-knot winds, and I forget, I don't think they really can...
Really bad stuff.
Yeah, bad stuff. You know, basically a light hurricane, if you will. But, you know, chains are a much different animal. And I think there's some value. What I'm thinking about here for my NAVFAC anchor, which is basically what I'm asking for, is to do just extra springs on the outboard side and use the weight of the chain to kind of attenuate. And it's going to be set in mud, so if I have a real problem, it's just going to jerk the stuff through the mud, you know, and I'm not going to have a major problem. But, you know, something's going to break. If you put chains on this thing right now, I guarantee you will break either a bit on the deck, a chock on the deck, or a bollard on the dock. There's zero doubt in my mind. There's broken bollards in the harbor here now, not where the Iowa is, but... It's a pretty significant amount of force.
I was going to say, those forces are mind-blowing because the sizes of these things, they're not insignificant little pieces of metal there.
So it sounds fun to do a chain, and you know, and I don't disagree with some of the interests, and certainly I'm not making fun of the question, but the engineering behind that is very significant. If we're going to chain this vessel, you have to have the physical structure on the dock that can handle that jerk load. You have to design it completely for that. And then you have to probably do a weldment on the side of the vessel and go through the analysis, the structural analysis for that, to be able to handle that load as well. So, you know, this is not a small issue. It's something we could do, but, you know, just off the top of my head, you're talking, you know, a couple million dollars of effort and maybe then some. You know, the new bollards would have to be inboard. I'd have to rearrange the entire mooring system. Yeah. And in fact, moving forward, this is an important question too. Someday the ship is fairly likely to move down south, and we're asking for what are they called, monopiles. The USS Texas had them back in the, or down in the San Jacinto State Park. In that case, they had collars that were attached to weldments on the side of the hull. And basically, these collars just rode up and down on these big piles, mm-hmm. kind of like a spud for a barge. You'd be very familiar with that, Joe.
Oh, like a floating
yeah.
dock.
Yeah, and so, and that's not a bad arrangement. I don't know how much that costs. That's something we would look at, because we don't want to be in the business of dealing with mooring lines on a regular basis, because frankly, it's a real pain in the rear.
It is.
And it's a ton of effort.
Yeah.
You know, just literally, it takes you 10 or 12 people in this chain fall, and you know, 3/4 of the day to tighten up 6 lines.
Yeah, we got so fortunate right before Hillary, because yeah. it's pinning season for Navy chiefs, and we had a chief group from where was that group from?
I don't remember actually. Was it Wainimi or down south, one or two?
Something like that. Yeah, but yeah. So we had a group of, you know, 20 or so chief selects up helping us out for the day, and they helped us take in awnings, they helped us tighten mooring lines
yeah.
while we dropped the anchor, and it was just very fortunate timing for us on that one, which is quite not the case in January. But yeah, fortunately, we have our ace in the hole over here that kind of got on the line with us. Hey, you should be expecting blah, blah, blah. And we did what we could.
By the way, I received a text this morning, Joe, from a sailing friend who said that they were expecting 6 to 7 foot swells hitting Long Beach this in the next day or two. So I don't know if you have any knowledge of that or
I can look. Okay. I haven't been looking as to, I'm not so sure the source, whether it's Southern Hemisphere or I know the Northern Hemisphere of the Pacific is getting active, as it typically does, usually around mid-August, meaning extratropical cyclones, so Bering Sea, you know, storms coming off of Japan, off of Siberia, that sort of starts up at this time of year. I'll take a look when we close up.
And we've been rolling actually the last week.
I mean, yeah, pretty, we have a lot.
Pretty significant, not surging, but rolling, and that's it. It's kind of a different effect here. It's really odd that you don't translate fore and aft, and you're just sitting there doing this all day, and you can't even tell out in the water. You look out across the 1,000-foot channel we're in, and you can't even tell. But
you have to watch the rail, and you can kind of feel it, and you're like, are we moving?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
then you
it's
go look, and you're like, yeah, we are.
Actually, I usually notice it because the doors are swinging around.
Yeah.
Yeah. So.
Yeah, that's true. They would do that.
And we have a couple of armored doors.
Interesting about the sort of the spud arrangement. You know, I mean, it is, it's amazing to me, you know, 45,000 tons and starts moving.
Yeah.
And that inertia, to break that inertia, you can't break it. You have to dampen it somehow
right.
slowly. And that's really, really hard to do without breaking other things, whether it's on the vessel, you know, lines. This great video, by the way, you know, on YouTube, of you know, ferries and all, you know, that might be in relatively exposed places, of actually having, in fact, I saw one a couple of days ago where basically the line started to go, you know, breaking, and then the bits started going, bollards pulling out of the dock and all, and the ship basically was underway moving. It was in an exposed location. I think it was in the Mediterranean. It was an exposed location.
I've been on a boat where we had actually in Redondo, we were on a dock close to the breakwater in Redondo Beach, and we started moving so much from the swell, we actually ripped a cleat off the dock, and it came clean up and over the boat and into the water on the other side, and we were all like, oh, this is going to be a fun night.
Yeah. Yeah, at the same time, if it was a ferry and it was in the Med, having been over there, spent a year in the Med, some of those ferry drivers are both amazing mariners and absolutely freaking crazy. They come flying into these little itty-bitty coves at 8-10 knots, do full throttle, back down, you know, med mooring, drop the ramp, and you're just stunned. It's just literally stunned.
It's one like night, Captain Ron.
Yeah. Yeah. And then, I'm talking 500 or 600 footers. You know, this is nothing small.
No.
And then I remember one night in Palermo, Italy, you know, some ferry came zipping in, because they think it's a Ferrari. Love the Italians, but you know, they come flying in, and suddenly we heard a yell from the wheelhouse. We're sitting in the galley having dinner. You know, we popped 2 lines, you know, and so there's like 8 people flying out of the galley fighting for a room for the doorway to you know, go grab some lines and double up, because he came zipping through too fast, you know. And even here, in addition to storms, by the way, not only do we worry about the surge issues and the weather-related damage, we also have to be concerned, maybe less so in the last few years, but concerned about vessels. We have these 110,000-ton container ships coming through here. We have 80 to 120,000 ton cruise ships leaving within 100 feet of us. literally. And you have this 1,000-foot channel. In the center, it's probably 55-foot deep. And, you know, inboard, it's probably 38 or so, I think, over here. But basically, when these ships come through, they literally have this mass displacement of water that pushes forward and also comes back around. And it's really fascinating to watch the ship, how our ship reacts to that. Mm-hmm. Initially, it goes forward, and then as this backflow comes back around you, it actually pulls us back south from a northbound ship or southbound. And sometimes you have the two ships passing in the night or in the day, and it's a pretty crowded and busy seaway. So it's a really interesting problem. I've had to talk to the port pilots a number of times.
Yeah, and we heard from...
Go ahead, Joe.
Well, we heard from the guys over at the fire station back in the January storms. They could hear our dock lines just groaning and creaking and popping. And apparently the same thing was happening at the Evergreen terminal across the channel. So it wasn't just us.
Yeah, yeah. Joe, you had something to say?
Yeah, that doesn't surprise me. No, I people don't realize when, you know, the vessels that are so large, they don't have to. But it is amazing how much they displace and how much motion they cause on the in the water as they're going along. And I've had the experience of being over shallow water out of channel with a big ship going by in the channel. This is actually a favorite place of this would be like north of Baltimore in Chesapeake Bay. And typically the tugs, we would run out of the channel. Well, what happens is that displacement is a wave, and so it actually draws the water from the shallows. So you'll actually see the shallows uncover, kind of like a tsunami.
Yeah.
And when the bow wave comes, basically, or the return wave, it's a huge wave that actually comes on. So the shallows actually uncover and then come over again. I mean, we weren't that shallow, but still, we'd be like in a 15-foot draft depth, you know, drawing maybe 11 feet. And we had to be careful, you know, on the edge. But then we get hit by a wave. It's just kind of the hydrodynamics that go along with it are really quite phenomenal.
Yeah, we've actually had, now that I think about it, even fairly significant damage, probably totaling, you know, 50 or 60,000 over those years, too, just from some of our early gangway arrangements were not that good, and you know, the cruise ships would come by. They, in fact, initially when we got here, had a 6-knot requirement in front of us, just as a standard speed limit for the channel. But further south from us, because of the poor conditions of the docks down there, they actually had limited it to 5. And so after one of the bigger events we had, I went and talked to the port pilots, and they actually extended that 5-knot limit all the way up the channel into the turning basin. So, and that's been helpful, frankly.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
But these big ships, and some of them are run without pilots. I think the cruise ships might be approved pilot folks or whatever, but I'm not really sure. But still, it's kind of crazy sometimes. Those big ships come in, and when you look at them, if you're standing out in the parking lot, they think for sure you're going to get hit.
You know? Yeah.
Yeah, and the propulsion systems of them are, especially the cruise ships, I mean,
yes,
they're designed to go sideways, spin on their own dime. They have thrusters up forward. They have azipods back aft.
Yeah.
So they can actually throw thrust in a variety of different directions.
Yeah.
So they're incredibly maneuverable. Container ships typically have one propeller.
Yeah.
You know, one main engine and one propeller and a big rudder.
Yes.
And that doesn't mean they're not maneuverable. It just means it's more traditional style that they have to do things.
Yeah. In fact, here they tend to have 2 tugboats on them as they come up the channel just for safety. And oftentimes, because some of them idle, you know, they're direct reversibles. And you know what we're talking about here, Joe, where literally the engine is connected. There is no transmission. There's no clutch. There's no automatic. The engine is literally connected to the propeller. And if you want the propeller to go forwards, you turn the engine on going forwards. If you want the engine or the propeller to stop, you stop the engine. If you want it to go astern, you reverse the valve gear and the fuel injection system, and you make the engine go backwards. And so it's a different animal. And some of them actually, I've been told, idle at anything from 7 to 11 knots because there's no need for them to maneuver. They're at sea all the time. They come into a port for 2 or 3 days, they offload. And then they head back out, you know, so they can idle at 11 knots all day long and they don't care. And so you often see the tugboats actually pulling with all of their horsepower back just to slow them down. It's really fascinating.
Yeah, direct drive was just coming in when I was driving tugs. We just did a study on a typhoon that happened last year that formed well to the west of Hawaii, and then moved northward across the Pacific, across all the shipping lanes, and transitioned from a tropical cyclone, typhoon, into an extratropical cyclone as it was approaching the Aleutians, and then was a very, very intense, large storm in the Bering Sea, and did quite a bit of damage in the villages on the west coast of Alaska, on the Bering Sea coast. Anyway, so we looked at ship performance. And one of the things, we about 25% of the ships that we looked at, it was 126 ships. And the eastbound ships, primarily container ships, but all motor ships, diesels, direct drives, were drifting. So they instead of trying to alter course and come underneath, they could maintain their intended track, but actually were drifting to the southwest of the Aleutians. And by drifting, direct drive means that they're not idling. Basically, that more than likely they actually were turning their engines off, save fuel consumption. But then also because if their minimum speed is 9 knots, and they need to just heave to, and that's what they were doing. And it was just amazing to see how many, the largest number I've seen in looking at ship tracks. But it's pretty cool. It's like realizing, oh, what does that really mean? Well, they're on the generators, but it means that they're actually not using their engines and using them when they need them.
That's fascinating.
Interesting. Yeah, and probably a subject for another podcast. I don't have super great concern, but we've actually had serious discussions about potentially being in a collision here.
Yeah.
Or collusion, or what do they call it?
Illusion.
Illusion.
Yeah. So, yeah. You know, these ships come up the channel, and literally we're at the turn of the channel. If they lose steerage, or if they have an unstart, for example, and they, because these engines are direct started, they basically inject air into the cylinders to get them going. And if they run out of air, they have some other kind of problem or unstart because of a fuel change, you know, you could end up with a collision. You know, and that's actually an oddly, it's not a concern to think about. We don't think it's super likely, but it's a possibility. We're in the main channel, big, big, heavy ships. Something happens. You look at the things happening in the Suez Canal or elsewhere, you know, where they have steering issues and off they go. So
yeah.
We're in a maritime environment.
Yeah. I wanted to just mention that I think it's pretty cool that you have approved, meaning engineered, mooring plan.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That it isn't just, okay, you have lines and they go out in these directions and that's it. No, there's actually a more than a science behind it, it's actually an engineering behind it as to how you actually moor a ship, you know, safely, you know, and so that it minimizes the forces on the ship, and the ship isn't moving.
Yeah. Yeah. It's extensively done. In fact, when I get a minute, I'll try to remember to throw it your way. It's out of interest. The forces are pretty impressive, you know, and so pretty cool stuff.
Well, on that note,
yeah, probably time, huh?
Yeah, you got a meeting coming up.
I got a gun shoot. I have to go shoot a gun, Joe. Sorry.
We got a party. We're going to shoot the 5-inch guns again, like we do.
Like you do. Well, you have those, so yeah.
Why not?
Yeah.
Well, thanks again so much, and thanks for all you do behind this. And I think another reason we wanted to do this was to give you a public shout out for all the help that you've been giving us through these storms and helping us keep this ship safe. We really appreciate it, and really appreciate you.
Oh, well, thanks. And I know who to talk to. Let's put it that way.
Yeah.
I've been a long time in an organization, but, you know, I don't do things, you know, necessarily by myself at all. So, you know, I always check with the local, you know, office as to what they're doing, because that's their responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
But I appreciate it. And it's always a pleasure.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
Joe,
all right.
Thanks.
So thank you, everyone, for jumping in with us. And as usual, if you have any comments, questions, feedback, or anything you want to shoot our way, podcast@labattleship.com. Shoot it over. Love to hear from you. And we'll see you next time on Scuttlebutt.
Till the next storm.
Yeah. Welcome to my life.